Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. I'm glad you're listening with us today. This hour, who this election's most essential women voters are and what they want. Now, there's a lot of dimension to the conversation. Think about it. The way women of color with college education see this election looks quite different from the way white women who have kept their jobs through the pandemic see it, and so on. But at this stage of the campaign, there is a shift happening among different groups of women voters, and it's noticeable, and we wanted to understand it better. So as our guests join us, women in the audience, I'd love to hear from you this morning. If you're a woman under 35, Republican, DFL, or independent, I'd like to know which issue will be top of mind as this election unfolds this fall. If you're in your 40s and 50s and 60s, what's motivating you in this presidential year? And women in that all-important senior voter group ends up being a very important voter cohort in the presidential race. Have your political priorities changed since 2016? So you can see I want to hear from a lot of different areas of women voters and a lot of different perspectives and voices on this, no matter where you are on the political spectrum. If you're under 35, Republican, DFL, or independent, which issue is really driving the way you're seeing this election unfold? If you're in your 40s and 50s and 60s, what's motivating you? And seniors, I'd love to hear from you as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Reach me on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. Our guest this hour, Kelly Dittmar, is with us, an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, director of research at the Center for American Women and Politics, with us from Philly. Kelly, it's really good to have you back on the show. How have you been?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me.
You're weathering the pandemic in Philly. Is that right?
That's right.
How are things there?
Things are pretty good here. We're staying at a good level. So we just hope that everybody is responsible and continues to do so.
All right. Good to talk to you again. Etta Collins Coleman is with us, co-founder of the All In Together campaign, a nonpartisan women's organization that's committed to closing the gaps in politics. You might have heard me talk about this with Mara Liasson a week or so ago, and Etta's with us from Orinda, California. Etta, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks so much. Good morning.
You know, Etta, I'm going to start with these guardian women that you discovered and wrote about in a poll that you put out in June. This is what I talked to Mara about. They are seeing this election through the prism of safety in the midst of the pandemic. Tell me how you identified them and who they might be.
These guardian women or suburban women are women that are on the fence, right? They have split their vote over the years. They've gone back and forth between voting Democrat and Republican. And so we refer to them as guardian women because they're defined largely as white, married, and over 50 years old. The majority of these women live in suburban areas, and they have an income mostly about over $50,000. And sometimes, for the most part, they do not have a college degree. And so what we see are these women who we like to compare these women to, like, the soccer moms, right, and security moms that were observed in past campaign years. There have always been these groups of women, I would say, who are really split down the middle in terms of their political affiliation, which is why they go back and forth between Democrat and Republican voting. Mm. And we see that, or we have seen in the past, that these voters were very divided, almost evenly so between, in the past years in 2012, like you look at who voted for President Obama and Mitt Romney. And then in 2016, this group split also between Hillary Clinton and Trump. And so our poll is really indicative of what potentially, you know, can happen this November, and that former Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee, has a small lead, really, with these guardian women or suburban women.
This is just to describe this for listeners. Your description in the polling, guardian women are different from women overall, in that they're older, slightly less Democratic and independent, and more Republican or nonpartisan. At the moment, when you polled in June, they're leaning towards Vice President Biden by 4 percentage points, with 12% undecided. So now I think I hear you saying that number might be volatile, that these are women voters who kind of move back and forth in their perception of candidates. Is that right? Is it, Etta, were you able to hear me? Oh, shoot. We lost her. Kelly, let me share something with you that we got from a male caller who called. But I think this touches on some of the puzzlement over how some women voters in a lot of different political stripes are making up their minds. He called to say, I really hope that Kerry discusses that white women still voted for Trump even after his inappropriate comments about women. He means in 2016. Uh-huh. It is mind-boggling. That was the source of a lot of, you know, numbers crunching and political analysis. Like, how come women were not turned away given some of the things that were revealed about President Trump in 2016? Do you have a better handle on that now?
Yeah, I mean, I think those of us who have studied women's political behavior for a very long time are always trying to remind folks that women are not monolithic and that they also don't just support women. So there's not what we call a sort of gender affinity effect at the ballot box that, you know, women would vote for Hillary Clinton regardless of their political beliefs because they supported her. Likewise, and to the caller's concern, I guess, women also display and align with sexist beliefs. And so some of Donald Trump's comments, his behavior, his rhetoric, his sort of navigation of gender roles is something that resonated okay with some women, right? That this was boys will be boys. It's just locker room talk. And they were more concerned about the attacks on men and their husbands and their sons. And we saw that both anecdotally in some interviews with women voters, but also in some of the polling that shows these levels of beliefs among women, and particularly white women. And the last piece that's really important is there's lots of really great research from many of my colleagues who've looked at really the combination of racism and sexism and talked about how white women in particular justify systems of sexism because of their racial privilege, right? So their racial privilege comes from their association with white men, their marriage to white men, et cetera. And so whiteness gives them that privilege, and they're afraid or unwilling to challenge that privilege in combating other forms of racism that we saw again fueling some of the vote in 2016. So okay, there's lots of reasons why white women were voting that way.
I just want to clarify what you said. I think that is super important. You're saying that some white women voters may vote for candidates who seem to express racist and sexist views because there is some kind of either subconscious or open acknowledgement that they benefit from the power of the status quo structure. Is that right?
Yeah, and I mean, if any of you have been, you know, paying attention, right, to the centennial celebrations of women's suffrage, this is an issue that has been part of the fight for women's vote from the start, that you had white women at the time saying, well, we've got to exclude Black women from this process because we want to preserve our own rights over the rights of Blacks. The frustration with having Black men vote first. So this is not new. This sort of racial cleavage in a lot of women's political behavior has been something we've seen for centuries. And so that's not the full, you know, the only explanation. There are other things, obviously, partisan alignment, ideological alignment on lots of other issues is going to inform women's votes just as it does men's. But I think that does get to some of the heart of the confusion that people have about how possibly, you know, could women support Donald Trump? Well, that's one way in which they might be justifying or looking over or condoning some of the things that they may deem as sexist or misogynist.
Good to have some insight on that. Let's go to the phones to Gretchen in Minneapolis. Hi, Gretchen. Glad you called.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, tell me what you're thinking about on this. Is there a specific issue? Is there an overall perception that's really catalyzing the way you see this 2020 race unfolding?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've generally been independent, leaning Democrat. Over the years, I've started to kind of lean more Democrat. And I think that a big part of that is that I really think that the candidates that I want to vote for see everybody as equitable and see everybody as human. And I don't particularly care for Joe Biden, especially with some of the allegations towards him. But I absolutely will be voting for him in November because I think that Trump is, he's just really focused on keeping the white male privilege in place. I absolutely agree with your speaker, because I think that he panders to the people who want to keep the status quo and want to keep their privilege. And that's primarily white men, but he needs more than just rich white men to carry the vote. And so he panders to the, you know, people in the middle class and poor white people who cling to that Confederacy and who cling to that just the white privilege as something that they still have.
So this is interesting, Gretchen. I'm really glad for the call, because Etta, what I think we hear in the way she took that apart, more of a vote against Donald Trump, a referendum on Donald Trump, less of an affirmative vote for Joe Biden. I'm seeing more of that on Twitter, by the way. How does that unfold when you do polling among women?
You know, that is an interesting question, because you hear this back and forth, and we kind of also heard this and saw this back in 2016, right? But the thing is, with polling, and I read something the other day, like, you know, guys can't believe the polls because things change. And as we saw in 2016, I really truly believe that it can, you know, fall the other way if people get into that voting booth and see that, you know, they may take a hard line one way or the other. In some of the polls that we've seen, we know that these voters with a substantial number of independents, you know, and non-affiliated women are true swing voters, a true swing constituency. And so we are looking back at their vote history over the past several election cycles and want to make sure that they report voting both Republican and Democrat and generally splitting their votes. So
Oh, my gosh, we lost our line again. Boy, this doesn't happen very often. If you've just gotten in on the show, I'll let you know what we're talking about. We are taking a look at where different cohorts of women voters are 4 months out to Election Day. And what is happening with some movement among those women? We haven't talked yet specifically about suburban women voters. I want to talk about that as well. I want to talk about how this breaks down according to college educations, what this looks like if you have weathered the pandemic well, been able to keep your job or not, if you're a woman of color compared to a white woman who is not college educated. There's some really interesting analysis going on with what's happening with women voters. And we asked two guests this morning who look at this a lot, dig into the analysis, look at the trends, to join us to talk about this. Kelly Dittmar is with us. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University. She directs the research at the Center for American Women in Politics. And we keep losing Etta Collins Coleman. She's co-founder of the All In Together campaign. It's a nonpartisan women's organization. Etta, are you back with us? No. Oh. We're having trouble with that line. Okay. If you're a woman under 35, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, I'd really like to know what the issue that will be top of mind for you as the election unfolds. I mean, is this about health care? Is it about the way the pandemic has been managed? Is it somewhere economics? Are you looking at this economy feeling uncertain or still feeling good about the way the economy has been managed? 651-227-6000. If you're in your 40s, 50s, and 60s, I want to know what's motivating you. And if you are in that senior cohort of voters, they are among the most reliable voters. I'd like to know, have your political priorities changed since 2016? So 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR, to Lacey in Duluth. Hi, Lacey. Hi, Lacey. Are you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks. Go right ahead.
I've been thinking about how the pandemic has been handled. Usually, I would say that my first issue is the environment, but I've just been seeing a lack of humility from President Trump. And in contrast, I've really enjoyed seeing how Biden has responded, especially as the unrest and all of the issues with the race that were going on right now. I really appreciate how he's responded by listening to Black leaders. And I just feel like he's doing a better job of being like a leader who listens to experts and, you know, doesn't have a huge ego. That's kind of what's been on my mind.
Lacey, do you get the sense that Vice President Biden is learning along with much of white America, that his views are being, influenced and changed by some of the leaders that you were talking about that he's been in contact with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, from the outside looking in, that seems to be what he's doing. On the contrast, Trump just kind of, he has his view and it doesn't change. It just hammers down on what his, you know, shallow worldview is. But I think a lot of people all over our country have been humbled by the virus and by what's going on with race right now. We're realizing we didn't know as much as we thought we did. And industries, business people, teachers, principals, we've all had to really change how we do everything. But I don't feel like Trump has changed any. You know, he's not really changing what he says or how he leads.
Really good to have your call. Kelly, there's a lot there. What would you pull out that is most informative for you of what Lacey said?
Yeah, I mean, I think this concern about what are we valuing in our presidential leaders? One thing that I've done a lot of work on is, you know, the association of the presidency with traditionally masculine traits or issue expertise. So the idea that our president needs to be tough and strong and assertive, needs to have expertise in national security. What we're seeing in this moment is perhaps a slight reevaluation of the things that we're valuing in our presidential leaders. So, yeah, maybe we do want somebody who has a bit more compassion, which is traditionally associated more often with women or femininity. We want somebody who understands and is addressing a social safety net and social welfare issues, again, an area where women are more often seen as experts and leaders because of their direct experience and engagement with social welfare system. So it's interesting to hear voters sort of rethinking perhaps what is most important. And that doesn't work very well for Donald Trump because he's played into a really hyper-masculinized approach to candidacy and office holding, right? This sort of tough man politics. That doesn't really work in a crisis like this, right? This isn't a military crisis. And when it comes to the racial reckoning that we're dealing with, it also raises a really important issue about how Joe Biden in particular is going to reach out to and mobilize and listen to particularly Black women voters. Black women voters voted at the highest rate of any race and gender subgroup in 2008 and 2012. They were key to Barack Obama's coalition and his success. And they voted at slightly lower rates, still more than most other groups, in 2016. But that even that slight decrease in turnout could be seen as really important, right? And so for Joe Biden, he's got to make sure that he brings out Black women voters, because we also know that Black women voters also bring out their entire community and mobilize their communities, as they've been doing forever. And so he's got to listen. He's got to take into consideration the voices and expertise of Black women on his campaign. And I think also even in his vice presidential choice, this is part of the calculation.
We missed Jane in Minneapolis, who points out what you did, Kelly. She says voters of color who turned out to vote for Obama didn't turn out to vote at all in 2016. Now, I don't know if that's quite true. Let me read the rest of what she says. Yeah. Those are the voters who can swing this election, not white women voters. Now, voters of color, women of color, did vote when they turned out for Hillary Clinton, but they weren't. Is it right, Kelly? They just weren't at the numbers that President Obama commanded in his election cycles. Is that true?
Yeah, I think your caveat is important in that, for example, Black women were still the second highest, you know, voting group in terms of turnout in 2016. So they're still one of the most reliable sets of voters. But yes, that turnout was lower than it was in comparison to the Obama years. And you saw that across different communities of color. I will say, though, what's happening at the same time, which I think your listener is referencing, is that you're seeing a growing electorate of communities of color, particularly Asian and Latino voters, that this is just these individuals and these groups are making up a larger proportion of the whole U.S. voting electorate.
I see.
And so it's not only that the percent of turnout needs to go up, but there just needs to be a recognition among all of the campaigns. If they want to win elections, they are going to have to reach out to communities of color. So I agree that we spend a lot of time talking about white women, when especially for Democrats, the name of the game is going to be, can you get your base, which are communities of color, can you increase turnout and expand your support among some groups, particularly, again, among Latinos?
And what that means for Biden and Senate candidates that are running in different states is not just not to take it for granted, right? I mean, that's a warning, right, to the candidates, not to just assume that you're going to have women of color or African American voters turn out, but to speak directly to issues because that may shape your policy, but also to reach into those communities and activate more of those voters to turn out. Yeah?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you look at the models of folks who have done this effectively. If you go back to Stacey Abrams' campaign in Georgia for governor, it was a really revolutionary campaign in the ways in which she was able to reach out to very diverse communities across the state, mobilize voters, and really focus on this issue of voter suppression, because these things go hand in hand, right? So we know that voter suppression is disproportionately impacting communities of color. And so how do you address those problems? And as a candidate, take them seriously and try to address them in real time, while also, to your point, really speaking to issues that matter most in these communities. And I would add here, just to be careful, to say the full diversity of issues and agendas in these communities. So when you're trying to do outreach to Black voters, that doesn't mean you're only talking about racial injustice.
Right.
You need to be talking about the full range of issues that you would normally be paying attention to, but recognizing the distinct experiences and perspectives that are coming from these communities and the diversity of opinions and thoughts among those communities. I think too often it's not only taking them for granted, but also assuming that all Black voters feel X about this position or feel in a singular way about any policy issue. And so it's really doing the work, investing your time, having the staff. And again, I think bringing folks to your tables that can help you better understand these issues.
Yeah, Stacey Abrams is just a fascinating political figure. I've read some lengthy interviews with her. We've tried to get her on the show. She is in a lot of demand. Somebody, a political figure that if you're interested in the next generation, right, the vanguard of rising political stars, you should know about Stacey Abrams. Ingrid says on Twitter, I'm 27 and I care especially about environmental issues, climate, conservation, abiding by bedrock environmental laws at minimum, as well as prison and housing reform that prioritizes equity. To Pat in Deep Haven. Hi, Pat. You are an independent voter. Is that right?
I am. And I, in the past, have voted Republican, Democrat, you know, depending on where we were. I'm 70, so I've voted quite a bit.
You have some experience with this. Yep.
Yeah. This time I'm definitely voting for Biden because I do not want to take a chance that Trump will get reelected.
Pat, may I ask you this, though? Interesting, because I think you've said you did not vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Does that mean you supported the president then?
No.
You did not. Okay. Got it.
2016. I voted for Evan McMullen, I think is how you say it.
And
he was an independent, and, I knew that his chances were slim because he wasn't even registered in all the states, but he was in Minnesota. And
so tell me, why not vote like that again, for some third party candidate? Why are you determined now to vote on one of the Republican or Democratic tickets?
Because I don't want Trump to win again. I think he's destroying our country. And so I guess in 2016, I was pretty confident that Minnesota usually goes to the Democratic candidate. Now I don't know what will happen. And I just do not want to. I hate the thought of, don't waste your vote by voting for a third party candidate. That's never stopped me before.
But you see this time around differently.
This seems so important. I don't know. I'm not even sure this country can survive another 4 years under Trump. The environment is, I heard the other caller that called in and she was younger. And I'm thinking, I'm worried about the environment, too. I think that's my number one issue. But I'm also worried about our standing in the world with other countries. I think our credibility is just shot, and I really would like to get that back because you cannot be an island unto yourself.
Pat, I really appreciate the call. We have a lot of people waiting on the phone lines, but we covered some ground there. Yeah, thank you, Etta. Okay. Etta, you're back with us.
Yes, can you hear me?
And I'm sorry. It's a problem on our end, so my apologies to you that we've had some technical issues here. I'd love to hear your insight on Pat's assessment as a usual independent voter. I bet you she echoes a number of independent voters and a number of independent women who see this pretty differently than they saw it in 2016. Now, tell me how that surfaces in your polling and your analysis.
I believe that within our polling, you can see that a major role for these women are protectors, right? They see themselves as protectors of the environment, as she was just saying. And universally, they agree that their political participation matters now more than ever to protect their country, our country, their families, that they feel they have a very important role in protecting their family and their communities. And so I would say that, these women are overwhelmingly will come out in droves and that they agree that their vote matters more than ever now and that their specific issue, whether it be environment, whether it be safety, or what have you, will show and be revealed when it comes time in November. I would also like to just go back briefly and talk about how, you know, Black women, I kind of heard that conversation a bit before I was
Yeah, we
off.
Lost you. Black yeah, women, go right ahead.
Black women are only about, 7% of the population, and you all may have talked about this, discussed this in detail, but, you know, we tend to vote at higher rates than other groups. Voting at or above 50%, I would say, in the past 4 to 5 presidential cycles. You know, we're also, as Black women, we vote Democratic. We are the most loyal voters for the Democratic Party. And in 2016, 93-94% of Black women voted for Hillary Clinton, the mm-hmm. highest rate of any group, including Black men, and nearly double that of white women. So, you know, Black women turn out of the polls, we organize our communities, our churches, our sororities, our families, and we bring them with us, like a sense of American history that we are, that we take upon ourselves. And it's often been excluded from power. And so, you know, Black women, we fought twice as hard for the vote. First with the women's suffrage movement, and then during civil rights movement, and which led to the passage of Voting Rights Act, that finally gave us that equal access that we've been seeking all these years and decades. And I would just like to say that we as Black women have helped usher in the most diverse Congress in U.S. history. We saw our numbers rise and soar in 2018. And then also we were very, very, very pivotal, not only when you were saying in the Georgia gubernatorial race with Stacey Abrams, but also we were completely pivotal when it came to the 2020 primary election in South Carolina. We shifted that entire field with record turnout in the first primary state. And, you know, the Black population there completely propelled Joe Biden to victory there. And so and it gave him the momentum to become, you know, later than nominee for the Democratic Party. And so I would just like to say that, you know, Black women, we are a force, and we should not be forgotten when it comes to the polls and it comes to not only registering people to vote, but mobilizing our entire communities and families to the polls.
Etta Collins Coleman is with us. She's co-founder of the All In Together campaign. And Kelly Dittmar is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University. Conversation about who these essential women voters are in 2020 and what they want. And we're hearing from a lot of you as women voters across the generational spectrum, across the political spectrum, what you want, which issues are motivating you, and what you want from this 2020 field and this election. 651-227-6000. Republican, independent, DFLer. Are there issues that are really catalyzing you this year? I'm surprised nobody has talked about the pandemic yet. I mean, they have talked a bit about security. I think we heard from somebody on health care. Is the pandemic a key driver in the way that you're seeing this election unfold? 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, where a listener says, I have several women friends that support President Trump. They have two things in common. They have sons and they have ties to the military and or law enforcement. They see the left as a threat to their way of life. We're going to talk about that on the other side of news and how President Trump is speaking directly to those voters that are looking at this culture and feeling uncertain. Back to the conversation now with Kelly and Etta. Kelly, I'm going to read that tweet again from this listener in Duluth. She says, I have several women friends that support President Trump. They have two things in common. They have sons and they have ties to the military and or law enforcement. They see the left as a threat to their way of life. And then she adds, there's no talking them off that ledge. I want to play something that President Trump said when he was out at Mount Rushmore late last week. And he was speaking directly to this. It's our way of life and it is under threat. So let's listen.
There is a growing danger that threatens every blessing our ancestors fought so hard for, struggled, they bled to secure. Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children.
And there's a lot of coded language there, Kelly and Etta. But I think what we're hearing from this listener in Duluth is that that is directly targeted at people who see the change and the reckonings and the conversation that we're having and feel deeply uncomfortable. Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we just have to be, you know, very clear, as we were talking about earlier, about what quote-unquote way of life is being threatened, right? So it is the white male privilege version of the United States that there is concern about losing. And the reason that women, some women, are also feeling that is under threat to them is because that is a system under which they've benefited. And so we know from many, many studies that both racial resentment and a sense of what psychologists call precarious manhood or precarious masculinity, the idea that we're threatening male privilege, but more particularly the idea that, you know, men just want to be men, that those two perceptions of threat on gender and racialized lines motivated voters to support Donald Trump in a way they didn't motivate Republican voters to support Mitt Romney, right? So there are clear comparisons that this was a different approach. Not that we haven't seen candidates use these same tropes before, but it was particularly effective for Donald Trump. And so in 2020, you're seeing him almost double down even further, particularly
right,
on these lines of racial resentment, which I think most strategists are saying, you know, that's probably not the best strategy in the sense that it is to a very targeted group of voters. But he's banking on those voters turning out at high numbers and then other voters not being able to turn out or not turning out, not being mobilized on the Democratic side.
That's what's puzzling about this kind of language. And as Kelly says, Etta, that the president seems to be all in on this strategy. The polling and the responses of, well, women and men voters who might have been in his camp or thought, well, let's see what, roll the dice, let's see what happens with 4 years of Donald Trump, seem to be pulling away from that kind of an approach. And I guess I would ask whether you see some of the reasons for that when you're talking to women voters.
Absolutely. And I think it's just fascinating the language that is being used, that he's using. You know, I would just like to say that every family, it's particularly women of all colors, and are looking, you know, to protect their families during this pandemic, to protect their families from the recession. And I believe truly it is what will motivate them to make their decision in November. We found that the polling found that these voters are providing more care. These women are providing more care for their parents and relatives, their
uh-huh.
children,
uh-huh.
than they did before COVID, above what, you know, what all women are experiencing. And so I think it's just a matter of, you know, watching this group of women and understanding them and needing to focus on the folks that are really trying to decide which way to go. But, you know, every woman I know, you know, who's caring for parents or caring for children and working and, you know, are just going through so many things. There was an article in the New York Times the other day, kind of with the premise that things were going back to the 1950s in households, you know, the way things are taking a turn
yeah.
with women working, caring for, you know, parents and children and trying to keep the household intact and keeping everyone safe.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that recently. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it is fascinating to me that these women, again, regardless of race or creed, will go to the polls and will be motivated by what happened, you know, with the recession and this pandemic, truly.
Call here from Olive in Minneapolis. Olive, thanks so much for waiting. Tell me how you're hearing the conversation develop so far.
I'm on break here. I'm an essential worker at Kowalski's, and I just stopped in when y'all were talking about just the group of people who are voting for Trump and the group of people who are supporting the Democrats, which is Black women.
Yes.
And it just, as a woman of color, as a young person, I just feel we're not asking for much. We're asking for the basic necessities. And as someone who didn't get any government money and is an essential worker and is paying rent, I am struggling. And I am struggling to find why Biden would be a better candidate than Trump. I don't want to vote for either of them, but I know it just comes down to getting Trump out, and that's very disappointing.
Olive, I think your view is shared by a number of people that I'm seeing on Twitter here. Elizabeth says, I'm 39, white, suburban. While Biden wasn't my first or third choice, I'm now excited to vote for him in November. Mallory says, I'm 34 and extremely disappointed in our choices for 2020. In a year when we truly need fundamental change, we're not going to get it. Most important to me right now are Medicare for all and drastic action towards climate change. But I fear we won't make any progress. Kelly, it seems that this hunger for the kinds of, I guess, more wide-reaching policies is really front and center with, I have to say, Olive, I think, is 22, Elizabeth was 39, Mallory, 34, with this younger set of activist women voters and this sense that, yes, it might not be President Trump, but we can't afford to wait for the kinds of changes that this group of voters. So when you talk with younger women voters, how do they express that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so first of all, thanks to Olive for being an essential worker in this moment and for taking the time to be engaged on these issues. That's who, those are the voices we need at the table. But I think, you know, young women, young people, actually voters across the swath of the spectrum are engaged in this tension between being most concerned about beating the incumbent, in this case, Donald Trump, versus or in coordination with making progressive, you know, swift change and really challenging the system as it is. And we saw this in the Democratic primary most starkly, in that at the end of the day, you saw voters in polling across groups say that electability was their biggest concern.
Right.
And when it came down to it, they felt like the older white man who's been in politics for a while was the safest bet. And so we have to rethink our ideas around electability, right? Shift it to realizing that the person who's electable is the person you'll vote for, not just the person who's been elected in the past. That's the first step to getting to a place where you're not in where we are now, which is having a candidate that maybe fewer people, especially young people, more progressive voters, are less excited about. So I think it's that tension that we're definitely seeing. We always see with young voters, I should add, right? Well, young voters tend to typically be more progressive and want to push further. But it is something in this cycle that we're going to grapple with when it comes to mobilization and turnout. And so the Biden camp really has to do a good job of speaking to voters like Olive and others and saying, I hear you, and I'm going to work on the concerns that you have.
Etta, you are a nonpartisan organization, the All In Together campaign. So I want to ask you about something that I was reading from the Barbara Lee Foundation. They've been doing some polling on women. They find that 41% of independent women voters, 30% of Republican women voters say they are more likely to support a female candidate. I wonder if more it looks like there's an uptick in Republican women candidates getting into the electoral process here. I wonder if that number is growing just because there are more choices, or has something else happened to be driving this idea that women voters are looking for more women candidates? What do you think?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I would say that the amount of Republican women that are running this year that has truly increased is a result of the, you know, the pink wave, if you will, that you saw in 2018 mm-hmm. with the amazing number of Democratic women who ran and won. And so I think and truly believe that the Republican women, it's definitely more diverse. The Republican women that are running, that have cleared their primaries, they're trying to put their party on track to beat their previous record of, you know, not having women or people of color within their party. And I think it's truly fascinating. We'll see how it will affect, you know, those down ballot races come November. But I truly believe that they saw that. It remains to be seen really how many Republican women will ultimately win this November, but they are trying to change their party. They are trying to make a record, a breaking year when it comes to Republican women still having they still have a long way to go to find gender parity in their party, I think. I would say that, but it's a great start. And the momentum is here for them. And they also, you know, we'll see not only, I think, for this general election, but for future cycles too, a push toward a more diverse Republican party and a party full of women who really want to make change in the party.
Boy, that's exciting. It's exciting that you're seeing that trend too. So, Kelly, I know you study this. I've got just a couple minutes left. What would you add to that?
Yeah, so at the Center for American Women in Politics, we're obviously tracking the number of women candidates, the trends over time, and it is a record year for Republican women in terms of their candidacies for the U.S. House, and they already have surpassed the nomination. So we're seeing more, but I think Etta's point and your point is, you know, we don't know what that will mean in November. These are women running in really tough races. Many of them are challenging incumbents. Many of them are challenging women incumbents who won in the last cycle. And so this will be a story about how well Republicans do, and if Republican women capture some of that success. The last piece on this that I think is important is they are still a very, very small percentage of their party's elected leaders. They're about 6% of the Republicans in the House are women. There's only 13 of them. Only 11 are running for re-election out of 435.
Oh my gosh.
And so even if we see gains this cycle, we're just trying to get Republican women back to where they were before 2018, which would be a gain of about, would necessitate a gain of about 10 seats. And so it is a steep uphill climb. I agree that it's a really positive sign that you're seeing the infrastructure support these women, but there's a lot more work to do after this cycle.
Kelly, always a pleasure. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Etta, so many apologies for the technical problems. Please come back, all right? And I promise
you
a better experience. All right, good. Etta Collins Coleman's group is called All In Together. They do some really interesting polling and analysis, so I would suggest that you check it out. And Cookie adds here, I still think an overlooked factor in 2016 is how Hillary was specifically demonized for a long period of time. Many voters would not choose another Clinton. This was generalized to thinking a woman could not beat Trump. More conversations about politics coming, of course, as the election goes on.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast, and thanks for listening.